Welcome to the Mastering Therapy podcast with me, Dr. Natalie Stock, clinical psychologist. This is a show for psychologists, psychotherapists, and counselors who are looking to build on their therapy skills, increase confidence in working with clients, and be inspired by alternative models, tools, and ways of working. Join my guests and me as we learn from one another and aim to take insights and put them into action. I really believe that this episode is a must listen. And it's not because it's more important than the other topics that we cover on here. It's because it's not talked about. And I'm talking about sex. In this episode, I sit down with Lou Cook, a psychosexual and relationship therapist. She has a podcast called After in Love, which is a great resource to recommend to clients. We go into why this topic is overlooked, especially when it comes to discussing it with our clients. We tackle the big questions. Do we routinely ask our clients about sex? Do we shy away from it because of cultural norms or because we find that uncomfortable? What I love about this episode is that there are very practical questions that we can ask, tips on how we can get a little bit more comfortable with talking about something that we don't often get training in. Lou walks us through some of her own journey in becoming a psychosexual therapist, when we as clinicians might need to refer on. We talk about the Plissett model, we talk about medication and why it's really crucial to consider that with our clients. If you find that this is a topic you never broach or you find you're uncertain about how to handle these conversations, then let me promise you this episode will definitely deliver on that. Since I recorded this, I can honestly and genuinely say that I've had conversations with clients that I would not have felt confident to have otherwise. And in follow-up to this podcast, we're going to be delivering a webinar together on exploring this topic in greater depth. There is a lot in here and it might be confronting. Get comfortable. I hope this intro has piqued your interest and I really hope you find it as valuable as I did. Enjoy. If you could just introduce yourself, Lou, and share a little bit about who you are and how you came to train as a psychosexual therapist.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Lou Cook and I'm a psychosexual and relationship therapist. I have a practice called After in Love. I love working with couples, but I also work with individuals. How did I come to this? Well, I, like many people in our society, grew up with a lot of sex shame and sex negativity, and I think it robbed me of many years of joy and pleasure and fulfillment in that department of my life. And so having reached a point in my 30s where I felt empowered and had my sort of sexual awakening, I really wanted to go and help others, the younger version of me, get through those years a lot quicker.
The first question I want to start with was actually to our listeners. If you're listening to this, I want you just to take a second and ask yourself, do I routinely ask about sex with my clients in therapy, just as part of my assessment? And if you're thinking, yes, I do, just want you to ask yourself the question, when was the last time that you did? I've done a straw poll of psychologists just because that's the people I have easy access to. And I had 68 people fill out this questionnaire where I asked varying different questions around how comfortable people feel having conversations around sex, the kinds of issues that people feel comfortable discussing, and the things that make them feel uncomfortable discussing. And what is really fascinating is that over 50% said that they don't routinely ask about it as part of their getting to know somebody or part of their sessions. And so my question to you as a psychosexual therapist is, should we be having these conversations with people regardless of what their presentation is? Because a lot of people will be thinking, well, it's not really relevant. You know, I'm seeing people for anxiety work or for low mood. I don't really need to be delving into their sex life. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm going to be a good guest here and say, yes, I absolutely do. And I do. And that's why I ended up specializing in sex and relationships, because that was, for me, the flag that I wanted to wave, because I do think it is so important. And sex is multifactorial. So much of our lives feed into sex, and sex feeds into so much of our life. So we don't just put it in a little box and send it over in that direction separate to the rest of us. It's holistic. It's part of us. It connects with mood. It connects with physical health. It connects with our relationships. It connects with our relationship to ourselves. And, you know, people have difficulty with sex. nearly 50% of people are dissatisfied in their sex life. So you're probably sitting in front of people who are having trouble in their sex life. And whilst they might not be there saying that that's the reason they're there, because it genuinely may not be, you can probably bet that a lot of them will be experiencing problems in their sex life that they would like to talk about if you give them permission. And that's the key.
This is something I think we just have to continually hold in mind, because it's really easy to fall back into that default of, oh no, it's a bit awkward, it's a bit difficult to ask about, and then we just don't ask about it. We find it hard to talk about. And I think that's because of the personal nature of it.
And because of our culture.
Yeah, and it's very private. And so naturally there is a resistance, I think, probably on the client's end to bring it up. Maybe for us, we're feeling like that's unacceptable to venture into. And if you're not feeling equipped or confident, that feels hard as well. What I thought was fascinating in this questionnaire, I gave people a list of responses to tick as to when it comes up in a session, what is the reason for that? Is it because the client mentions it? Is it because you routinely ask about it? Is it because it was mentioned in the referral or in that initial call with somebody? And half of the clinicians said the only reason it's spoken about is because the client brings it up. And that, I think, is really important information for us, because if we're waiting for clients to bring it up, maybe it's a really important issue, but because of all the taboo, because of how private it is, clients don't feel confident to bring it up. And so maybe a large part of things don't get talked about because we're not asking about it. It just highlighted to me how important it is to give people that permission.
Yeah. And that doesn't surprise me at all to hear that. And I have total empathy with therapists that aren't bringing it up. I understand. I get it. Like, if you're not trained in how to do it, and you're not trained in how to respond to what might come back at you in the room, and you haven't done your own personal work on really unpacking how you are with sexuality, then it's a really hard thing to carry and contain in the therapy space. But yeah, you're right. People will sit there for week in, week out thinking, can I bring this up? Am I a weirdo? Does it matter? Is it relevant? Is this a space I'm allowed to talk about it? We could dispel all of that by just setting them up in the intake with a question, giving them permission.
The client is sitting there wondering, is this relevant? How do I bring it up? And the therapist is sitting there thinking, is this relevant? How do I bring it up? And I do feel it's our responsibility as clinicians to help tease that out of somebody and help set a safe framework for them to do so. So when I think about things like sleep, I'm not a sleep therapist. I don't have specialist training in sleep. And yet I feel confident that if someone comes to me and they're not getting sleep through the night, there are a few things, a few ways that I can support them to be able to sleep better in order that they can live their life in a more functional way. I had a really good sleep conversation in the last season with a sleep expert. And it is that thing of, unless we ask about it, maybe people won't mention it. And yet it affects a lot of people. And so I think the longer you go on without it getting mentioned, it gets harder. And so those first few sessions, when you're getting to know someone, when you're setting the expectations for what therapy is going to be like, that is really quite important. And so we ask about sleep. We probably ask about social support. You'll ask about risk. Sometimes we're asking people, have you ever had thoughts that scare you or worry you? Have you ever had thoughts of not wanting to be here? I mean, this is incredibly personal stuff we're getting people to share. And yet sex is this little thing over here that is massively impactful for people. And yet we don't ask about it. What has your journey been with understanding why people don't ask about it and why therapists in particular have found that hard? Is that something you've had to process through in terms of your own feelings around how comfortable you are in talking about it?
Yeah, I've got client experience of being desperate to talk about sex in couples therapy, and 2 years of couples therapy where I brought sex in and my therapist couldn't hold it. It wasn't carried forward, and there's only so many times I could bring it. So I had my own experience as a client of being like, I need to talk about this. Then I've got my own experience of just being a female in the UK and being raised in our culture. there's a great sex educator called Emily Nagoski, who's written amazing books about sex. And she talks about these three ways that we develop an understanding of sex. So morality, medicine, and the media. And if you think about that, what media have you consumed growing up in formative years that's taught you about sex? Well, for some people, it's porn. It's also Hollywood. You know, sex is easy. Sex is something that everybody enjoys and has amazing orgasms. It works every time. People are desperate for it. So it teaches you a certain thing. I grew up reading Just 17. It was all about pleasuring him. And it was nothing to do with female pleasure. Our messaging around consent through the media. So there's certain things we've learned through the media. Then it comes to the medical aspect. Well, we're taught about STIs and the risk of getting pregnant. And that's kind of it. Like, that's how we learn about sex through the medical angle. And then around morality. Well, maybe you're involved in religion or maybe you're not. But either way, we are told certain things about sex in this culture through our morality. Often women are told different things to men. So we are slutty if we want it, and men are wimps if they say no. There's just a lot there about shame, essentially. And I was a product of that. I didn't know, I'm going to be very explicit here and get a bit personal. I didn't know what my vulva was till I was in my 30s. Okay. I just called everything down there my vagina. So that's me, a normal female in this country. And I don't think I stand alone there. I had my own journey with it and my own sort of sexual empowerment thing in my 30s, like a lot of us do. And that propelled me into wanting to go find the younger me's and go help them out a bit.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just sex that I wanted to work on, but sex was a part of it because sex is a part of all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that has led you to do your psychosexual training. What does being a psychosexual therapist entail? Do you do couples work? Are you doing individual work? Is it for people that are having sexual issues? Is it for people who are wanting to explore their sexuality? Just when we're thinking about when someone needs further support, when we might think, okay, this is out of my realm and I need to refer to a psychosexual therapist, can you just help us understand a little bit more about what you do that would be specialist?
So I deliberately found psychosexual training that also incorporated relationship training. And so often they're delivered separately. And I don't think they come separately. I think if you're working with relationships, you should know how to work with sex. And if you're working with sex, you should know how to work with relationships.
Yeah.
I've done both, which means that I can work with individuals and couples. And I've done private work and I've done NHS work. And you see different things in different places. But you're there to help people work with any dysfunctions and figure out how to help them through that. You work with people who are exploring, and that might be their identity, their preferences, all that side of things. And then you can also work with people who are okay in a good spot, but want to take it further and elevate things, whether that's on their own or in couples. So yeah, right down from the really nitty gritty, these parts are not working, help me.
Yeah.
All the way to the more aspirational, we want to feel excited about our sex life again, help us. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Part of me wonders whether, you know, when we're thinking about bringing it up with clients and waiting for clients to bring it up with us, what came out of the questionnaire that I did was that around half of the respondents said that the reason they didn't bring it up was because they didn't feel equipped to know then how to support someone. And you alluded to it earlier on when you said not being able to handle what comes back at you. So many of us might feel okay to ask the question or open up a conversation around sex, but it's then what you do with the information that comes back at you. And I think probably educating yourself is a really good takeaway. What do you think is a good route to go down for education, for upskilling yourself in knowing what options are out there?
Well, I'm a massive fan of podcasts. So I can recommend some really good podcasts. There's also obviously some fantastic books. There's also COSRT, which is the registered body for the College of Sexual and Relationship Therapists. And they put on courses, lots of CPD. But also I think just in any areas that we have trouble broaching with client, I think it's helpful to have a scaffolding sort of structured approach. So I've developed my own and there are plenty out there to look at. But if you want, I can share with you a sort of simple scaffolded approach to taking a client through that conversation.
Any practical tool that you can give people is going to be really useful, because this feels like a bit of a minefield. And it feels quite a scary, big topic. And because of the uncertainty with what people will come back with, that might be a barrier to us asking. Hopefully some of this conversation will stimulate people to think, do you know what, this is actually important to ask. So where do we start? Tell us ways in which we can ask these questions that feel very casual, that don't need to feel this big mountain, that feel accessible.
Okay. Before you bring it up in the room, do your work. That would be the first thing I'd say. Go and do your own work with sexuality. Get yourself to a place where you are feeling confident, where you at least know what your biases are and you've been able to shelve them so that you can bring a non-judgmental stance to the room. I mean, answer some questions, pull out some polls, get hold of something that's going to help you really dig into your relationship with sex and sexuality so that you're going in aware. When you've done that, then a simple way to bring it up is just to say, would you like to talk about sex or sexuality at any point as part of this therapy? Something as easy as that in your intake. And if they say yes, then you say, okay, could you give me a brief snapshot of what that's about? And listen. If they say no, then you say, okay, but just so you know, this is a space you can talk about that. So if you change your mind at any point, please feel free. There you go. So there's a model called PLICIT. It's an acronym and it spells out P is for permission. So that's what you've just done by asking that question. You've given them permission. You've shown them this is a space that they can bring anything. The LI is for limited information. SS for specific suggestions. And then IT is for intensive therapy. So if you work your way through, you give them permission, and if they say yes, they want to talk about it, this is where I've slightly adapted PLICIT, because it doesn't then talk about exploring what it is they want to talk about. So pause after the P and go into an exploration with them. And so for me, again, I have a little bit of a structure to what I like to say in order to help them tell me what it is they want to share. Obviously, let them tell you what it is they want to say. And then the way to explore it deeper is to say, okay, well, let's talk about sex. So do you want it? And is it working, essentially? And on that, you're gauging, like, what is their level of desire? And by asking around, is it working? And we're talking about, this is where erectile dysfunction might come up, or vaginismus, or those body parts are not working. Arousal is not happening.
Yeah.
And then you want to go into the three Ps. These are my three Ps. You're asking about pain. You're asking about pressure, as in relational pressure. And you're asking about pleasure. So you want to find out, do you experience pain or discomfort when you're having sex? Because so many people aren't asked that question. Even if they're talking about sex with a therapist, you know, that's often a question that's missed. And actually, that question is quite essential, right?
Are you talking about physical pain or the emotional pain?
No, I'm talking physical here. Like, is it physically painful or uncomfortable to have sex or have sexual touch?
Yeah.
And then you want to ask about pressure. So you say, do you experience any pressure to have sex, either externally or internally? Because that's going to tell you where people are at.
So your own expectations of yourself, that I need to be having sex this many times a week, or it is my duty to have sex, or I should. So when you start noticing the shoulds, oughts, yeah, musts.
Yes. And then you go into pleasure. So tell me about, how do you experience pleasure sexually? Do you experience pleasure sexually? What's that like for you? Are you able to orgasm if you want it? Not that you have to. So they're the kind of three main areas that I'm asking about after I've got into, do you want it and is it working? And the reason is because then you can focus on how you're going to be able to help them. So if it is a pain thing, then you're actually going to want to refer them. That's going to be, okay, let's get you an examination. You can help them get an appointment with a GP or a physical health therapist or whatever it is. Usually for us, it's to your GP, right? Because then they're going to take it through to who it needs to go to.
Yeah.
But things like erectile dysfunction, it's an early warning sign for cardiac issues. So again, it's essential to actually take note and take action on things like that. And that's way out of anybody's who's a general therapist's competency. So we send them off to get their checks done and make sure that it's not what we would call organic. And then around the pressure, well, if you're establishing that someone is just pushing themselves to have sex because they think that their partner will get in a stink if they don't, or they think there's something wrong with them if they don't, well, you're well equipped to deal with someone to talk them through consent and boundaries and asserting themselves, right? It's a relational thing, a relationship to themselves and a relationship to others. So that's well within your competencies and comfort zone. But by asking, you're getting the information you need to help your client. And then with pleasure, so often we find that especially women are there trying just to focus on pleasuring their partner. And if you're not having fun while you're having sex, you're not going to want to have much more sex.
Yeah.
That's going to get to the desire issue. Someone might come in saying, there's something wrong with me, I don't want sex.
Yeah.
Well, as soon as you're getting into the nitty gritty of, well, are you enjoying the sex you're having? Well, if the answer's not really, then you can help somebody make that link and actually lead them down a journey into exploring pleasure. Chances are they're not having pleasure in other areas. A lot of this is not actually that technical. It's more just pulling on the threads and seeing what's there and then working therapeutically with them.
Yeah. This is also where our own biases come up, because if we're not feeling confident to talk about it, then we're going to shy away from that. The reason that I decided to do this episode was because I was aware that it was something that I had never been trained in, and yet came up in some training that I did in my second year of clinical training in a cancer placement. And I just realized that I was confident in talking about it in a physical health setting and asking clients about sex in that context. But in all my other contexts, just felt like it was not broachable. I didn't really have the guidelines within my own mind of how I go about having a conversation around sex. We're so trained on how to discuss the physical and the emotional impact of someone's illness, yet we rarely focus on the sexual. Then my colleague in some of the group work that we did on that training, she said that she'd worked with a man for 2 years, and only at their penultimate session did he mention his lack of physical intimacy with his partner since his cancer 3 years prior. He felt shame and embarrassment, which had led him to avoiding discussing it. And at the same time, she was realizing, I can't believe I never even asked about it.
Have you ever been curious about using AI to do your note-taking after your therapy sessions? The admin juggle is real. Using AI to transcribe my notes has quite literally changed my practice forever.
I'm going to be running a 70-minute webinar that you can join live and you can have access to after and watch as many times as you would like. I'm running this on Friday, the 25th of April, 2025. So put the date in your diary.
This is a step-by-step guide on how to use Heidi Health, the note-taking AI software for therapists. If you're curious about how it works, including concerns around consent and GDPR, or if you're already using it and want to ensure that you're maximizing the features, then this webinar is for you. Join me and sign up at masteringtherapy.com or click the link in the show notes.
The thing that really shocked me that I learned on the training was the impact of medication on libido, on sexual performance. What do you understand to be the connection between medication? And is that something you just always ask about, bearing in mind that some medications are going to impact sexual function?
If someone tells me they're on an SSRI, I'm almost guaranteed to assume that they're having some form of sexual dysfunction. I mean, it's 60% of people on SSRIs are reporting that. Lack of desire, delayed orgasms, problems with arousal, those kind of issues. So it's huge. And the problem is that depression feeds that stuff as well. So is it the depression or is it the SSRI? We often don't know, but you can guarantee if you've got a depressed client on an SSRI, they're probably having some sexual dysfunction.
So that is a great way that we can also start that conversation. If it feels difficult, it might be a helpful thing people can hold in mind thinking about the role of medication. One of the things that came up in the questionnaire was that people felt more comfortable to talk about sex when it was related to physical health or to like an illness, so erectile dysfunction or vaginismus. People might hear that and think, fantastic, don't need to deal with that because I can refer on. But when you're opening up a conversation around pleasure, One of the things that came out is people spoke a lot about how uncomfortable they felt broaching the idea of masturbation. And I think because of how personal that is, it's really quite difficult to know how much detail are we now going into. When you started talking about asking people how they orgasm, I'm immediately thinking, this is out of my comfort zone. Like, I'm not sure I'm equipped to educate my male client on how he can best do that. I'm noticing my own nervousness in, I don't know what I would do if they did say, I don't really feel pleasure. Would I then be referring them to a podcast, or actually is it about creating a narrative where they feel like they can realize that that's missing in their life and that that's important for them?
Yeah, so you're bringing up quite a big thing here, which the sort of masturbation element, and we prioritize partnered sex. In fact, when we use the word sex in our culture, we are talking about partnered, heteronormative, penis in vagina with an orgasm sex, okay? That is our shorthand to that. And anything that falls outside of that, we're uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
Because that's not the script.
Yeah, yeah. And that came out in the responses. That was clear as day. Feel comfortable talking about consent and boundaries and maybe even asserting ourselves, but anything that's to do with anything else that's outside of our box, no thank you.
Right. And what we're doing is we are putting people in such difficult positions, because for so many people, that isn't how they want to experience sex. And they already think there's something wrong with them. They're creepy, they're broken, whatever. So if we're reaffirming that sex is that and only that, and that's the space we'll give them, what are we saying to them? Actually, for women, that ain't where it's at. Like, for most women, it's all about the clit. And we're not giving them permission to really want that and own that. And don't get me on my bandwagon, but solo sex is a beautiful part of our sexuality and should be embraced and celebrated and normalized. And so again, if we can check our own biases and get ourselves into a place where we can come away and just help normalize people's experiences, people are masturbating, people deserve to, people have the right to, and we have such a problem with it, especially if they're in a relationship. Well, sex should be for you and your partner. Well, no, we could eliminate a lot of problems if we really just normalized masturbation and said, you know what, crack on with it, pleasure yourself, find your own way to orgasm, and then stop pressuring your partner. There's all different ways that actually promoting, celebrating, normalizing solo sex, however you want to word it. I hate the word masturbation, so I'll talk more about solo sex. As soon as we've shown the client that we're comfortable enough to say it, to name it, to normalize it, you can see them instantly just relief.
Yeah. I'm thinking about a client that I was working with who was really struggling with sleep, and she was in her bed revising, watching TV, getting ready in the morning. Like, so much of stuff was happening in her bed. And I remembered from this psychosexual training that I did that they said, your bed should be for sleep and for sex. So I said this, I'm using my training. So I said this to her and she was like, oh gosh, no, I don't have a partner. And so my response was, well, you know, you don't need to have a partner in order to be sexual. And she was absolutely terrified at that and retracted. And I didn't know where to go after that. I just wonder how you might deal with that, because it's all very well us going in super confident, nothing can faze us. But actually, sometimes we're having to manage what the client is bringing and remembering that they're coming from these scripts that they're feeling shame about, they're feeling uncertain about. And is there not risk of us intimidating a client with being too overbearing? We can all see it. We can see it in body language, facial expression, when someone's feeling uncomfortable. When you see a client not responding, maybe feeling, oh gosh, she's going there and I don't want to go there, how do you respond to that?
I think we use our clinical judgment to know what to do in that moment with that client. I think with some people, we name it and we say, I noticed you recoiled. Are you aware of what you're feeling as I ask that question? And we use that grist for the mill. For others, that might be too much. So we pivot. We put that one on the shelf and think, okay, noted. You do what you do with any other difficult topic that people are talking about. It's no different.
Yeah. I thought it would be really useful to share a few things that people highlighted in this questionnaire that feels really uncomfortable to talk about. And more often than not, it was when things were outside of their realm of what they felt was their sexual script. So kink, BDSM, polyamory. I had a referral actually from someone who said they wanted some EMDR for trauma. And then they said, and it's really important that I have a set therapist that's comfortable with ENM and understands it. Well, I didn't know what this was. I had to Google what it was. And then I realized, oh, okay, I knew what it was. I just didn't know the acronym for it. Obviously, we're not expected to go down this route with people, but we do need to feel able to at least have a conversation. So what is that journey, do you think, for therapists going from feeling completely clueless about other expressions and realms of sex to feeling comfortable to be able to have a conversation about it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how can we get comfortable with that?
I think there's a difference between feeling clueless and not knowing versus feeling closed and judgmental. And I think it's important, it's our duty to make sure that we are inclusive and welcoming of diversity, and that we have some level of competence around diversity. We don't necessarily need to sit in the room and agree and align with somebody's own perspective on their sexuality, but can we be curious and open and help them explore it? And that's the question. So another acronym, GSERD, which is kind of trying to replace LGBTQIA alphabet soup, and it's gender, sexual, erotic, relationship, diversity. And there's a fantastic sex educator called Meg John Barker, who's written a fantastic paper on it and books, multiple books. And I would recommend everybody that takes this seriously to just go and get that paper and have a read and get themselves up to speed, because we don't want our clients to have to educate us on everything, but we're able to come with a certain level of knowledge and competence and then support them in exploring it. So we don't have to be the experts, but it's our duty, isn't it, to go and get some education, update ourselves and get education around these key things.
Yeah.
Oh, I do want to just give an example of a client that I've worked with who has been in individual therapy alongside couples therapy with me. And his individual therapist was helping him with a completely different issue to what he's there with for me, with his partner. And they are practicing ENM, ethical non-monogamy. He ended up having to end it with his individual therapist because the individual therapist just kept bringing up polyamory. And he was like, I'm not here for that. But his individual therapist kept bringing everything back to polyamory. And so in the end, he just said, I got tired of having to answer myself for this life choice when it had nothing to do with what I was there for. And so at the very least, we need to be aware of these things and be client-led and not bring our own presumptions in around what is at the root of all their problems.
Yeah, yeah. An important point that somebody raised, which I've also had experience of actually, is when working with a male client in a session, they brought up sex, but they were talking about it in a way that I felt was to provoke a reaction from me. I was a trainee at the time and absolutely felt like a rabbit in headlights. I really hope that I didn't show that. But it seemed like there was something in the interaction of them getting some kind of satisfaction or gratification of making me as a female feel uncomfortable, being very confident and dominant with talking about sex. Have you ever come across that? And have you got any advice for how, if that shows up for us, how we can handle that? Would you name that in the room with someone?
So I have got experience, but it doesn't happen often. And actually, I've had some brilliant conversations with male clients about sex without it feeling like it's gone into that zone. And again, I think it comes down to clinical judgment of what the best move is in that situation. But you're wanting to always, aren't you, to notice what's happening in the room and observe it and sort of check in with your inner supervisor about what the next best move is. You're wanting to stay grounded. And if it is naming it, or if it's refocusing and redirecting the conversation and then taking it to supervision to dig deeper, there's lots of ways to handle it, but it will depend on you, your relationship with the client, how far you're into therapy, etc. But I don't think it should be a reason to put us off opening the conversation up in the first place.
And the other thing came up was around pornography. And I know that there are various different things around the prevalence of pornography, especially as social media has developed and internet access and the impact of that, especially on younger minds. What do you understand to be the relationship between when somebody is using pornography for their own solo sex and gratification to when it becomes a form of escapism or impacting their day-to-day functioning? Almost like we'd say you can go gambling and that can be fun and can be you and your drive system and having enjoyment versus this is actually now an addiction that's impacting your life. Have you had to broach that much with clients?
Or drinking a glass of wine with your meal versus being
absolutely
addicted to alcohol, right? So what we do know is there's higher usage of pornography for men than there are women, and more so amongst young people. But about 75 to 87% of men use pornography, and at least half of them regularly, we're talking weekly. It's much less for women. It's about 30 to 50% of women using pornography. But of all of them, only about 5 to 10% are reporting it as problematic. So it's a small number of people who have a problematic relationship. And of them, it's an even smaller number that would fit into the category of what's called the compulsive sexual behavior disorder in the ICD-11. So we're talking more like 3 to 6%. And that 3 to 6% is covering across the board sexually, okay? Mm. Only a small amount of that is related to pornography. So I guess what I'm saying is treating it like anything else, really, any other behavior that could lead to compulsive behaviors. I think pornography does get a bad rep, and I'm not necessarily someone who prescribes it and promotes it, but I'm definitely not against it either. And I think that a lot of people use it for their pleasure and their stimulation, and they use it on their own and they use it with partners, and it's not a problem. I also think sometimes people report it as a problem, not necessarily because they are compulsively using it, but more because of the judgment that their partner is throwing their way or that culture is throwing their way. I've had people come to me with addiction to pornography when they've been discovered by their partner that they're using it. And addiction is actually just a nice way for them to sort of say, I'm ill, it's not my fault. And so I actually help them unpack that and see that there are reasons you're using it. And the only problem here is her pain with it. And that's a relational thing that you two need to deal with relationally. So I think it's really hard to put our finger on exactly how many people are having serious problems with pornography versus the whole soup of what else is surrounding it.
At the end of the questionnaire, I asked people, is there any kind of success stories or anything difficult or learnings that you've had in these kinds of conversations that you'd be willing to share? And I think a couple that I wanted to flag, one being that it is really important that we don't just assume. And I think that comes back to your point around sexual scripts and being really aware of your own bias, not just assuming that somebody is heteronormative and assuming what their preferences are, just because that's what your preferences are. I know that probably goes without saying, but unless we're conscious of our bias, it's going to come up. So really being aware of that is the first thing. A lot of us will do trauma work, and there are a lot of people that have maybe been experiencing sexual issues because it's connected to past trauma, whether that be sexual or non-sexual trauma. And I do think we have to be mindful of that. And so I don't know whether there's specific training that you get in your psychosexual training around whether you navigate trauma conversations differently, but that would be something that we need to make room for in an assessment, that not just assuming that sex is kind of as simple or as easy as it might seem, because there's trauma involved and we have to be a bit more sensitive about that.
Definitely. There's a lot of sexual trauma in people's histories that, you know, we might never know about unless we ask. And like you say, it doesn't have to be sexual trauma to impact their sexuality. Trauma of any kind can impact sexuality. So yeah, there's a connection. We do have to be sensitive, and we have to know what we're doing when we encounter it. We have to know when it's out of the scope of our competence and when to refer. trauma is a whole specialism in and of itself. So yeah, it's very tricky. But I think one thing I've learned about people that have experienced sexual trauma in childhood is that there's a huge, huge piece of them that feels complicit. And that's the really difficult piece to work with, because they were ultimately powerless. They were children. But a lot of the time they come out of it with just a residue of, but I let it happen. I didn't say no. And maybe their body even responded to it in a way that sort of they enjoyed it. They didn't. Their body responded how it responds.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, there are some good resources I can recommend for anyone that wants to dig deeper into that. Yeah.
And there's that added complexity, I think, around the ethical dilemma of maybe disclosures of historical childhood sexual abuse. I'm actually doing an episode on that around the guidelines that the BPS has and the complexity for us as clinicians in working out what we do with that when that does come up in these conversations. Mm-hmm. And linking to that, something someone shared that I thought was relevant is this idea of holding power was really important for this particular client within their formulation. And so an assessment of their sex life and sexual interests were really helpful in adding to the formulation and helping the client get in touch with their underlying vulnerability. So asking these questions really can add to a client's understanding of themselves.
Can I also just add one thing on sexual trauma? A lot of people can subvert what happened to them in the past. They can subvert it into fantasies and fetishes and kinks to kind of reclaim their power. So you might find someone who was sexually abused in the past now has rape fantasies. And it's about normalizing that. And actually, they might feel hugely broken and wrong for having these fantasies now. How could I when that happened to me? But if we're able to just hold them in that and say, well, you're now in control. These fantasies, you're the author. You get to decide what happened. You weren't back then. So it's, again, if we have a basic understanding of how that all works, then we can help sort of really normalize and help someone come to terms with that.
Mm. The other thing that I think is relevant to bring up it that people mention was around age. So people, one, finding it maybe easier to talk to adolescents, being the adult, maybe talking to adolescents around sex, puberty and consent, but also recognizing that sometimes that feels harder because it might feel, some people said that it felt kind of inappropriate to ask. But what I'm getting from this conversation is that actually, no matter what age somebody is, if you are from the offset making it known that it's possible to talk about, it then does pave the way for it being easier if it does need to be spoken about by the client. And then a couple of people mentioned working with older adults, and we class older adults, I think it's like 65 plus. And someone had said, oh, I don't really ever ask about it because I'm not sure it's as relevant. And my response was, gosh, I hope I'm still having sex at 65.
Yeah, and chances are, if you are, you might be experiencing some difficulties, because we do. Our bodies are changing. For women, we're going through the menopause. Men are aging. And that is impacting our function. And the way that we experience pleasure in our younger years, it's going to change. We're going to have to adapt. So people who have fulfilling sex lives in their older years are people who have adapted, have learned to adapt. And there's so much shame and stigma around aging and sexuality. So we as therapists want to dispel that entirely and be able to allow our older client to be sexual and have a sexuality still.
Yeah. I wonder whether when we're approaching this topic, our attitude towards it should be, not always is it appropriate for me to talk about it, but what circumstances would it not be appropriate? If we have this as our default, then we're actually enabling the client to be free. We're overcoming our own hesitation. And I think that can only be a good thing. It can only lead to conversations that might otherwise not have been explored. Just like the story I shared around working with someone for 2 years, and this had been something this client has held and did the whole hand on the door thing when they're leaving, of like, oh, by the way, this really significant thing in my life that I felt shame and embarrassment to talk about. In terms of resources then, we'll put lots of things in the show notes. What would you say for someone that wants to explore this further? What are the go-to podcasts that you would recommend?
So Emily Nagoski, who I mentioned before, she's written a seminal book called Come As You Are, all about the science of female sexual pleasure. She has the same named podcast, and they are half-hour episodes where she's condensed the main points. I refer clients to that so much. So go and listen to Come As You Are. There's about 8 episodes. Then there's also Justin Lee Miller does a brilliant podcast called Sex and Psychology. He gets different guests on each week and they just unpack the science and the research behind sex, sexuality. Love it. It's fantastic. And then there's also Kate Moyle, who's a UK psychosexual therapist. She's brilliant. And she has her sexual wellness sessions. So there's 3 to start you off. Enjoy. Is this a good time to mention that you and I are going to be providing a webinar as well?
Yes. Yeah, we'll put details for that in the show notes. I think from the outcome of this, it's just highlighted how important having training on this is. And there are so many routes you can go down, but we're going to do a 90-minute webinar on an extension of this podcast, really of how you can feel confident in having those conversations, common things that come up for clients and how to respond to them, and then a ton of resources if people do want to go more specialist in their knowledge. So yeah, there's details for that in the show notes also.
So we've got you. We've got you, listener.
Well, Lou, thank you for coming on the podcast. You've given us so many nuggets. And if people are intrigued by this topic, they've enjoyed listening, then do sign up to our webinar. You can do that on the Mastering Therapy website. Hopefully we'll see some of you there and can delve into a little bit more about our own biases and how to overcome those.
And I'd also like to just say that if your audience are listening and they've got just a quick question, something, an idea that they just want to bounce, then I'm really open for people to shoot me an email and I'll answer any quick, easy queries around this.
Yeah, great. Thank you. You have been a wonderful guest. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Mastering Therapy. All of the resources mentioned are available in the show notes. If you're interested in getting more information on what's been covered this season, you can sign up to our mailing list or visit the website masteringtherapy.com. If you've listened to this and you've thought of someone you think would be great to interview on the podcast, submit a recommendation on the website. I'd love to hear from you. The Mastering Therapy podcast and the information provided by me and my guests is solely intended for qualified professionals.